Game On. Game On 2FM.
Hello, you are very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. Well, I'd be lying if I said it has been an easy day in RTE Sport. We're all completely shocked and saddened to hear that our old colleague and friend Bill O'Hurley passed away suddenly this morning. For everyone in the sports department that was lucky enough to work with him, he was a brilliant broadcaster and a very generous, approachable and decent man. His death has had a huge impact in RTE and further afield today. It's only fitting that we reflect on him and I suppose how big an influence he has been on Irish sport and everyone that knew him. Eamon Dunphy and Alan Cawley are with me in studio. And as it happens, we spoke to Bill on the day of his retirement last year. And this is a small reminder of the man that we lost today.
I represent the plain people of Ireland. And when I work on television, I have only one function, and that is to unlock the knowledge of those with whom I work. I don't posture or pretend I have knowledge. I produce knowledge.
Fantastic! I said it to start. Ciao, Roma! Buongiorno, Roma! What do you think, lads? Magic.
We think it was fantastic. No, we think you're being silly. No, we think it was bloody great. The team played magnificently. The tactics were right. We ground them down and we played our football and we deserved everything we got.
You know, let me tell you for a start, before we join our panel for discussion, that ALF has been deferred and Home Away has been deferred and we're on the air until 10 o'clock.
That World Cup in 1990 was almost the beginning and the end of it for Eamon Dunphy because of the view that he took, which was very much anti-Ireland, and he got a really, really tough time because of it.
He did. He got a very tough time. His car was nearly turned over when he came back from Rome, having attended a press conference that didn't take place because Jack Charlton wouldn't have a press conference with Eamon present. But there were people who objected, no question of it, because there was a sense that we should have joined in the national celebration. But I've always argued that one of the big mistakes RTE made was that when O'Leary scored the penalty that put us into the final shake-up, as it were, in the World Cup, we were dancing around in the studios, and RTE should have been a shot, because there were loads of cameras there, there should have been a shot of us, and then they would have fully understood that there's a difference between objective comment and the subjective emotion of really supporting Ireland at a time like that, you know? But it's a very different thing. They're paid to be objective in their comments, but behind it all, they're huge Ireland fans.
Will you miss them?
I missed them very badly because, I've had great fun with them over the years. I've learned an awful lot from them. I've learned also that the most important thing an anchor must do is listen. And the two people I respected most of all in that capacity were Gabo, in the first instance, and Michael Parkinson. And their career was distinguished by the fact that they always listened. They didn't go in with a set agenda necessarily. They followed the sense of a discussion in a very real way. And that's what I did. And I got great fun because, you see, we did a survey around the time of 1990 that showed that only about 32% of the people understood the game. So my function then was A, to educate myself, and B, to educate the public, but not in a preachy way, to do it in an informal way, to bring the people with us. And that's what I have always attempted to do. And it has been very easy because it's been a learning experience for me as much as has been for the audiences. And I've loved it. I've loved every minute of it. I've worked with great people. I've enjoyed myself immensely. So I leave with no regrets at all.
Highlight?
Well, 1990, it has to be. I think that was very special. That was a historic time for Ireland. And I think when I look back on everything, that was the most important time for me, I think, in broadcast.
My work on soccer, and most especially with the Three Amigos here, has been the great highlight of my career. Eamon and I have soldiered together since the 70s, John since the 80s, and Liam from the 90s. Of course, we've had our differences, like when I sometimes lost the run of myself and imagined I was an analyst rather than an anchor, and it got very much put in my place. But I've had so much fun over the years, I've learned so much about football, and frankly, and there's no doubt about this, I have piggybacked on the talent of these three gentlemen. So we leave it there, so okie doke. Good night and God bless. And thank you very much, lads. Well,
quite emotional listening to that, Eamon, I can only imagine.
Yeah, but it's a lovely piece, and it captured the essence of Bill, the passion, his skill as a journalist, and his understanding of his role, The one thing he said that was wrong was that he owed us, in fact, it was the other way around, John, Liam and I, and anyone else who worked with him, owed him a debt of enormous gratitude for his professionalism. He was very prepared. He was, you know, a joy to work with. Very prepared, very robust. He challenged you, and it's a wonderful clip I heard on News at One today of him and Liam having to go off each other. And Liam saying, "That's rubbish, Bill. It's rubbish."
Yeah.
And but Bill would have done his research, and he got me going one night about Roy Keane. He had a piece from the Sunday Times, and of the previous week, and it was described Keane as a thug, and it was, and I was at that stage.
Cross parallel.
I was Roy's PR man, as they say, and I lost the head completely. And but he didn't set out to do that, but he said it certainly set out to represent the viewers, to challenge the received wisdom or the conventional wisdom of any given match or any given day, and that's a very important thing for journalists to do. He was a great journalist, and he mentioned in his few words there, Gay Byrne and Michael Parkinson, who were also, in Gay's case, still is a great broadcaster, and Bill belongs with them.
The beauty of him for me, I grew up watching him and you guys, and I suppose only when I've come into this job now that I realise how easy he made it look what is actually very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. He made it look easy. He never seemed under pressure. But he was a very conscientious man for preparing for programmes, and he was just brilliant on his feet. He was a smart guy too, and he did, you know, he said he represented the ordinary people, the plain people of Ireland. He was a very bright guy, and he represented people very well. He communicated, he was a great communicator with people. I think he captured the emotions of that moment when, you know, in 1990, when we won the penalty shootout, for example. He had the ability to capture the mood of the country at any given time, in many great sports occasions, Olympic occasions as well. The only thing I think I ever, time I think he was down during the Michel de Bruyne stuff. I think he was, that was an unhappy period in his broadcasting career with RTE. But apart from that, he was an ebullient, passionate, smart, and very decent man.
You grew up watching him as well as I did, Alan.
I did, Hugh, yeah. And just listening to the piece there, all the memories come flooding back. And obviously sitting at home on a Wednesday night or wherever the Irish matches were on, watching the lads and Bill kind of controlling the whole situation and then letting the boys at it. And they're the memories we all live with, every fan at home, every footballing fan, all the sporting moments that we remember growing up as kids, Italia 90, all the major tournaments, even only up till the World Cup just passed. And I even get emotional just listening to them moments, because he was part of everyone's life, even non-soccer fans. You'd even hear women who were maybe sitting at home watching the match, and they'd always have a fond word for Bill. And you'd just see with the comments that everyone is paying tribute today, he was loved by everyone. So it's
just
some legacy to have.
That exact point, that was my next point. Everybody loved him. And that, again, in a sport, particularly football, that divides so much opinion, that's an incredible thing to have.
Yeah, I think what you saw on the screen was very much what he was, passionate, decent, joyful kind of guy. He loved the big occasion. He loved the great occasion. He was at the IFTAs last night because he's chairman of the film board, and he was there last night. He would have loved that. He loved the glamour, and he never got cynical about sport. It's only sport, or it's only this. It was never only this. It was always, you know, a matter of immense importance to him, and it, as it is to people. And Alan was saying, you know, people are the lifeblood of our business. You know, this is what we work for, people. And no one worked more for people than Bill, and gave more of himself emotionally as well. But he was, I think, people get a sense, if you've been around a long time, they get a sense of you, what you're like. And I think people had a wonderful fondness for Bill. He was a real Irishman.
There's a real cruelness, though, for me. I mean, I remember that interview on the day he was stepping down, and it was a bit of a do from here in RTE. And I was thinking to myself, God, he's got so much now to look forward to. He can take the foot off a little bit. And then he's just taken away less than a year after he retired from work. And I'm sure he spent so much time making sure that he would have been comfortable and able to do the things that he liked to do. And that's been taken away from him and his family.
Yes, I mean, he was actually involved in a new project, an internet project. He was in here on Thursday and Friday doing some work. I was talking to Eugene, our producer, our soccer producer, and he said he felt a bit tired and wasn't feeling great, but he was still working. I think he loved engagement with people. He loved to work. He wanted to work. He loved to play golf. And, of course, in politics, you know, he was a very... He came from Current Affairs. And before that, print journalism with the Cork Examiner, as it then was, now the Examiner. And it's a very, very good pedigree as a journalist outside of sport. And it's to RTÉ's enormous credit that they take sport so seriously that they put someone like Bill in charge of the great moments, the Olympics and the World Cups and all of that, and allowed Bill to do his job as a serious journalist, bringing all that training and all that scepticism and rigor that you need and applying it to football. And it's true of RTÉ Sport in general. The caliber of people in, you know, is high, intelligent, rigorous, good journalism. And Bill was, I think, the greatest of them all.
Because in order to be accepted by people, you have to understand people.
Yeah.
And he understood people, didn't he?
He sure did. He sure understood me. And
he understood you, which some people are still trying to work out.
But no, I mean, he and Liam, there was a wonderful clip played on the news today of Liam disputing something he said. And Liam said, "That's rubbish, Bill, it's rubbish."
Yeah.
And Liam was really gone.
You know? I know.
And I was often in that way as well. John and he had a more statesman-like relationship.
Okay.
And John was the elder statesman and Bill understood that. And
so what would happen then, a blazing row, the two of you going, the camera, okay, we'll leave it there, and you can see everyone is still on tenterhooks. The camera closes and you guys stand up and you shake hands and say, job well done?
Yeah. I think we never really had a falling out. John and I had a falling out once, so it's nothing to do with the programme.
Okay.
He gave me a bad review for a book. Can you imagine how trivial, how small-minded I am? But no, there was never any fallout afterwards. I think certainly Bill understood better than anyone that it is part of it's show business, it's serious, but you don't, and he took it seriously, but he didn't take himself seriously. And, you know, I hope I don't take myself seriously. So we were all friends, very, very good friends. And we were all deeply shocked. I have to break the news to Liam, who's in Spain, and he was devastated.
God.
Yeah.
It's funny, Eamon, actually describing that, because for us sitting at home watching it, Hugh, you could see them relationships. That's exactly how they were. It was like John and himself had a little kind of bond going on. And John always sat on the inside with him. Then Liam was kind of, if Liam got annoyed, he was ready to go. And obviously Eamon on the other side then. And you could see them relationships over the years that were obviously started from the bottom and worked their way up in the relationships to work so long together as well on a programme and be it so good. Because no matter what football channel is on, everybody tunes in to hear what the lads have to say after the match. And Bill obviously carried that for so long as well.
George Hook said today on another station that it takes a very clever man to appear stupid and get away and be as successful as he was. And that was the thing I think that people most associate with that. He put himself into the mind of asking the question of the person who doesn't understand.
Yeah, in that clip you played of Bill's last interview with you when he was retiring, he said that. He did put himself in the place of the viewer and, you know, he did represent the voice of the common man. And I think George Hook is right. It does take someone clever, I suppose, to understand and put themselves in that role. But, you know, I would dispute the fact that people who are watching aren't clever.
Sure.
But I think I know what Bill was saying, that he represents the man who watches sport and woman, of course, the men and women who watch sport and devote their love to sport, and that these so-called experts in the studio with him have to be challenged and challenged robustly if necessary. And he was prepared to do that. And he was very, very good at that. To do that, though, you need to have done your homework. And he always had done his homework.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll all miss him. And as you say, I just, you know, for yourself this morning, waking up as the rest of the country did when the news broke, just this level of shock, because people just assumed a guy who was only recently retired had so much left that he probably wanted to do. And I think that's the real sadness that goes with this.
Yeah, and for his family, of course, for Sally and Jill, his daughters, and Hillary, you know, they'll miss him terribly.
Can we talk about the end of the Premier League? Because we finished up and I read your the highs and lows of the season, if you like, but the one thing that struck out for me and stood out for a lot of people, I think, is that this season has not been a vintage year by any stretch. In fact, it's been very poor.
It's been very poor, Hugh. I think that's a view shared by almost every observer. Mm-hmm. It's been a miserable year. Chelsea have dominated from the league from day one. And I think in the end, even they got bored because they were grinding results out.
Yeah.
As if this is something we have to do. There was no one to really challenge them. They are an interesting but not very attractive team. It's based on defence. I mean, Mourinho is not blessed with gifted attacking players. One or two exceptions, Hazard being the most obvious of them, but didn't have Diego Costa for most of the season. And he looks like he might be a bit of a dummy as well, you know.
Yeah.
I fancied him at one stage, but I've gone off him big. So you have a pretty ordinary team, very professional, closed games down, got the goal, managed situations. You know, that's not going to get the pulse racing.
Okay, well, you know, you're an open critic of Jose Mourinho. You're not his biggest fan, no. While you're respecting what he's done. I mean, I'm looking at this season, and I was reading back a couple of articles today that kind of reviewed this season, and Chelsea actually had started to play some pretty good football early on, but Jose Mourinho, for me, recognised that he could win this league by setting his team up to defend, and that actually, if he could do that, there wasn't a side capable of playing the type of football that it took to beat Chelsea, and that's what he did.
Well, that's the way it's panned out, Hugh. To be fair to him, but I think to be fair to him, at the start of the season they did play some very good football, as Eamon said, when Costa, I think he went on a run of 8 or 9 games, he scored every week, and they were playing some really good football, because all the arguments that we heard was Abramovich was after bringing Mourinho back because he wanted, he wasn't happy with the style of play in the first term under Mourinho, so to bring him back he needed to up the ante a little bit in terms of it, more entertainment, I suppose. Obviously signing Fabregas and Costa helped that. Fabregas had a great start to the season. But as Eamon said, it was almost around Christmas time. I remember Eamon was on the show with us at Christmas. They got hammered by Spurs, Harry Kane. And they went on a run after that, because it looked at that stage, even we were joking about it, you kept saying Man City are going to come back into this and catch them. We were saying no. But it was like as if they flicked the switch then and it was back to Mourinho mode. And it was like,
shut down.
Shut up. Yeah, exactly. And we'll get the one goal. There was an incident against Hull, I think it was. And they played in the KC. And look at Hull after being relegated. But it was 2-2. They went 2 up and Hull got it back to 2-2. And Chelsea scored to make it 3-2. But he was on the verge of bringing on an attacking player. Now, he's not great. Cuadrado, another signing. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the goal went in, changed the substitution and brought on Mikel, who's basically just a stopper in the midfield, Hugh. Shut up shop. And that was the mentality, as Eamon said. And that's all they needed to do after Christmas, because the wheels had come off with Man City. Obviously, United were going through their troubles the whole season, not just since after Christmas. So it was almost a case of they were winning it by default, because the rest of them were so bad, and that's the way it's panned out.
Mourinho recognised this. And the next stage is then, Eamon, I'm looking at next season, and we hope we have a better season next season. So the question is, can Manchester United challenge Chelsea? Can Manchester City get back up there and challenge them? Will Arsenal finally bridge that gap? You know, couldn't Liverpool possibly spend enough money to come back up there? You're shaking your head.
There isn't enough money in the ECB for Liverpool, I'm afraid. I don't think it'll change very much. I think that, in fact, Alan, Fabregas, after a sparkling start to the season, just amazing goal where him, Hazard, and I think he played it through to
Shirley, I think it was.
Shirley for the goal. Yeah. But I thought Fabregas went off the boil.
Yeah.
Didn't look fit, didn't look enthusiastic for most of the season. I wouldn't have had him anywhere near my team this season. And he was a big shock, because, I mean, I've always rated Fabregas. I think Chelsea wouldn't have to do an awful lot. Now, it depends. A lot of money will be spent, in theory, in the summer, but where are the players who want to come to the Premier League who are good enough to change things? I don't think Manchester United have a prayer of getting the number of players and the quality of players they need. There wouldn't be enough money in that bank either, in the ECB, for that. And even if the money was there, who's going to come? You see,
this is it.
People don't want to go to Manchester. These guys want to go to London. I mean, Guardiola, for example, Pep Guardiola said he didn't want to go to Manchester City, but he said if he went to England, he wouldn't mind going to London.
Yeah.
So these guys, these are multimillionaires now. They can make choices. I don't see any hope very much for the Premier League. We love it and we'll miss it during the summer, but I think it's a desperate league.
I think it's poor Hugh as well. I really do.
Look, he's finished second, third and fourth.
Yeah.
If we go back to even just 2 weeks ago, the semi-finals of the Champions League, the first legs in particular, the standard, that's where the standard's at. And you look at the English teams, they're a million miles away off that. You could imagine Man United with the current team playing against the Bayern Munich or Barcelona. They'd be destroyed, Hugh. I watched the Class of 92, that documentary, the other night. And I nearly started crying watching it when you think of Ferguson and Beckham and Scholes and Giggs and all these players and what we've been looking at through the years of United. And you look at what they are now. Honestly, they're
a shadow.
They're not even a shadow.
No.
Rooney. Rooney's the only one, bar Rooney. There's not another player
and
I think.
He's 30 this year.
And Rooney's getting on. The Gea, it looks like the keeper's going to go to Madrid. With the exception of those two, it's a poor outfit.
By the way, Carlo Ancelotti has been sacked as manager of Real Madrid just in. No surprise, I suppose. But I suppose the question, Manchester United fans, if this Gareth Bale rumour is, and is there any strength to it at all, will that change his position at the club? Depends who's going to come in. It seems like Klopp might be coming to Spain. Apparently he's been taking Spanish lessons.
Really?
Yeah. I think
Gareth Bale, my understanding is that Ancelotti wanted him out of sight 2 months ago. But the president insisted they'd keep him in the side.
Because they paid so much money for him.
Yeah, and he's had a really poor season after having a very good season last year. But I think the trouble is that Ronaldo runs the show there, half the show, and Casillas and Ramos run the other half. Mm. So it's a divided dressing room. And for someone going in like Gareth Bale, or indeed a manager like Ancelotti, it's a nightmare. And I think that soap opera will continue. And they need to sign some players. They're not a very good team anymore.
Rafael Benitez, by the way, is the main guy being linked with that job. In Liverpool, can we talk about Liverpool for a minute? Because I know there was a very good piece by Dion Fanning yesterday in Sun Independent where he basically said that Liverpool are trading on their past still and that there is no vision for the future. There is no hope. Whatever about Manchester United getting players to sign for them, Liverpool have not a prayer of getting top players to sign for them.
I don't think they will. I don't think that the Fenway Group, which is an American group we know, will get involved in signing very big checks, the kind of checks they'd need to sign. So the Sterling situation is bad. I don't see much hope for Liverpool. And my son and my grandson are Liverpool fans, and I'm a Liverpool fan. I love the club. I love the history of the club. I don't see any hope for them, Hugh. I really don't.
Wow.
The only thing with Liverpool, I have a little bit of sympathy for Rodgers in the sense that Hugh, last year they overachieved finishing second, and that raised the expectation massively because everyone thought, this is it, Liverpool are back, he's the man that's going to get us the league title, and they thought they'd win it this year. If they had to finish fourth last year and just get in the Champions League, he would have been far better off because the expectation wouldn't have been as high to mount the challenge this year. You lose Suarez out of that team, then he loses Sturridge, who you have to remember was brilliant when Suarez wasn't there last year. Then he has to deal with this Gerrard thing that's dragging on for 6 months. Mm. How he handles that, the goodbyes, the kisses, all this nonsense. Who's been a great player, to be fair, Gerrard. You have to give him the send-off. And now this Sterling thing. So I'd love to sit Rodgers down behind closed doors, and I bet you he'd give you a totally different answer than what he's saying in front of the cameras.
Yeah. I agree with Alan. I think he's right. I think Rodgers has had a terrible hand of cards to play.
Yeah.
And you know, he did the best that you could expect. He gives hostages his fortune because of his fondness for himself and his quotes and all of that. There's a whole thing out there that doesn't help. But he's done a decent job and signed some decent players, and he's improved Sterling. He improved Sturridge massively.
Yeah,
he improved Jordan Henderson, who I never thought was a player.
He still isn't. but he has a lot of Jordan Ibe now, who looks a very good player. Yeah, who he signed. I'd say give him time. I'm not sure he will though after yesterday. And I agree with Alan again. The whole Gerrard thing, I'd say that explains yesterday. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just you have to have 11. Live men on the field.
Yeah.
And if one of them's, you know, on his way to the airport, it's not great.
He's been the talisman for so long. Even Carragher going back to losing him, there's no real leader now or no man in the dressing room amongst them that's going to drive it forward. Like I do have sympathy for Rodgers. He's been dealt a difficult hand there. Now, I know people say, well, he spent such and such an amount of money, but it's hard to get fellas to gel together as well, Hugh. You know, you can take punts on fellas, but you're spending so much money nowadays that you basically want the finished article as soon as they walk in the door, and not everyone's like that.
There's a transfer committee he's got to deal with. He should have walked when the transfer committee was instituted. He should have said, okay, I'm off.
That's the stuff nowadays. Yeah,
I think he'll look back later in his career, and maybe not too distant future, say, I should have walked when that transfer committee bought players that I had to use.
Yeah.
Some of them are dummies.
Yeah,
even,
absolutely.
Even going back to Ferguson, like, Ferguson controlled everything. Imagine someone trying to tell Ferguson, you can't sign this fella. You know, he would have told him.
Yeah.
Whereas now the managers are walking into jobs and being told, well, you can't do this and you can't do that and you have to listen to this fella. And it must be so hard for them, you know.
Very quick word before we leave this on Wes Hoolihan. Back up in the top flight with Norwich today. Brilliant win for them. One more shot at the big time.
As you're saying this, me and Eamon are hugging and kissing here.
Hey, listen, I tell you what, there's an awful lot of people who are delighted to see Wes Hoolihan back in the Premier League and to hopefully show what he can do with the big boys.
Yeah, well, he did it at Wembley today.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
He's a wonderful, wonderful player. And the big question around the Scotland game, which is vital for our chances of qualifying, we have to win it and we have to play Wes.
Imagine Wes and Jack Grealish in the same team together.
Sure, look, we've been shouting from the rooftops about Wes for how long, Hugh? Unbelievable player. It's a crying shame he has only 18 caps, but look, we're not going to finish on bad word. Delighted for him today. He's back in the Premiership, and exactly as Eamon said, he's got to play against Scotland.
Eamon, on the day that's in it, you've lost a very good friend. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
You're very welcome back. 51552 for your texts at Game on 2FM on Twitter. There are a lot of them in on Bill, and I will get back to them, I promise you, before the end of the show. But I want to move on if we can, because Limerick claimed a massive scalp in the Munster Hurling Championship yesterday with a dramatic and pretty entertaining 1-point win over Clare in Semple Stadium, it has to be said. I'm delighted to be joined by former Waterford hurler John Milan. John, did you enjoy this one, first of all, from a neutral's point of view?
I enjoyed the second half, Hugh. The first half, I suppose, like anyone else, it was a bit disappointing. But I wasn't surprised the way the first half was going to pan out. Paul Berry, the Limerick selector, you know, he outlined before the game that, you know, management teams, it was kind of going to be a tactical battle. And I think Limerick were always going to counteract what Clare were going to bring to the table. And I suppose it wasn't until both players were sent off that it kind of really opened up, to be fair, you know.
Is that because both of them had employed that sweeper system and, you know, they were set up quite similarly? Is that why they were cancelling each other out?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it was. And, you know, I outlined in Game on the Friday night why I thought Limerick were going to win the game. I thought they were going to try and nullify both Tony Kelly and Shane O'Donnell. And, you know, if it went a long way to winning the game. Tony Kelly, you know, probably didn't have the game that he would usually have. Shane O'Donnell, you know, was very effective, but only scored a point. And from the Limerick point of view, you know, when Clare were going to be down, the services of Colm Galvin and McGrath, for them, it was all about nullifying them too. And it came across that way that they were going to win the game.
I mean, watching it at home, John, I was kind of waiting for the Clare resurgence. Even when they had the man down, I was waiting for them to come back at some stage, and I was wondering how Limerick would handle that, because their form hasn't been great if you look at the league campaign, and they're obviously very disappointed to lose to Dublin. And I wondered, if Clare did come back at them, how they would handle it mentally.
I suppose the most interesting thing was when Limerick went down to 14 men, Clare kept persisting with the sweeper, which was interesting to see, instead of pushing on. And I suppose the one highlight for Clare was the performance of Aaron Cunningham. But I suppose the one team, you know, that are well capable of having a good championship coming off the back of a poor league campaign are Limerick. And we've seen that in the two previous seasons. You know, Limerick, you can never judge them on their league form. They're just that type of county, they're that type of team. You know, and buoyed by that massive support, you know, that support is worth an extra 3 or 4 points to him. And you know, they always are formidable opponents come Munster Championship, and you know, they're after getting that win under their belt now, and you know, Tipperary will be very cautious going to the Gaelic rounds, and you know, it's another 50-50 game now in 4 weeks' time.
And looking at Tip's record against Limerick, last two Munster Championship meetings between them, Limerick have beaten Tip, so they won't fear them. And even look, a few of the quotes I read this morning from the lads in the squad, it's given them a massive confidence boost as well. So they've nothing to fear against Tipperary.
Well, look, you look at the Munster campaigns the last two seasons. Tip have yet to win a Munster Championship game since 2012, was the last one, the Munster Championship. Limerick, on the other hand, you know, their last five championship games within the province, they've won four of the five of them, bar that defeat last year down in Cork in the Munster final. So, you know, Limerick will go into this game with a lot of confidence. You know, they'll probably have a few of their players back. Breen, Kevin Downs came on as a sub yesterday, and they'll probably have Nicky Quaid back as on the goal. And they'll have this young prodigy of Ronan Lynch probably to pick from the next day when he has his even sort out of the way. So I think all in all, I think Limerick are in a great position going into that game. Clare, it's not all lost for Clare. I think Clare are going to be dangerous opponents in the All-Ireland qualifiers. Mm. But for Davy Fitzgerald now, he's got one massive decision now. Does he go knocking on Podge Collins' door and say to Podge, look, you know, we'll leave a little bit of leeway there for you in regards to football. Cratlow played a weekend in the club championship, so I think Davy will have a keen eye on those club fixtures the weekend. And for me, I think...
Do you think he will, John?
I think he's got to get Podge Collins back. I think, you know, he's got to go and come to some decision. And I think he's got to act fast, because I'm looking at the fixtures now. You know, the Clare footballers won the weekend, and the Clare footballers could be out of the championship, could be mid-July. Going into late July, and it could be too late then. So for me, I think Davy's got to act fast. I think he's got to leave a little bit of leeway open to the likes of Colin McInerney and the two Collins brothers. That's three players. If they can get Colin Galvin back, they'll have Brendan Bugler back, Conor McGrath. You know, I think the more options Davy has, I think the better will be going forward for him in the summer. As we've seen yesterday when he brought Bobby Duggan, Shannon Amore and Aaron Cunningham off the bench, the more options he has, I think the better equipped they will be going forward for the summer in this championship.
Well, John, I don't know David Fitzgerald, but I mean, I suppose the glimpses that I get from listening to him being interviewed and from a few people who do know him within the department here, is he the type of person that will say, okay, look, I need to go back and revisit this, and maybe I was a bit quick to make that decision about Podge Collins. Do you think he will go back and revisit this and try and get Podge back in?
Well, look, my dealings with Davy at Waterford for 4 years, he is set in his ways, but I think he's no option here. You know, Clare, you know, they're in a bad run of form. They haven't won a championship game now since 2013. You know, they've been relegated in the league. And I think Podge Collins, I would rather have Collins in the panel than not in the panel. So I think Davy's going to be left with no option but to go and chase down the Clare footballers and see can we get him back on side.
Very interesting to see if he does that. I suppose looking at their record, and you mentioned Tip's poor form and Munster, Clare's record in Munster has been pretty awful as well, and that hasn't been an impediment to them doing well, obviously you mentioned in 2013. But you know, for Davy and for Clare now, you know, it's a different road they have to go, but it's not necessarily a road that they'll fear either, I suppose.
No, absolutely not. And as I said to you, if they can get all that personnel back on board, they're going to be formidable opponents for anyone in the qualifiers. And I think they'll be better equipped this year than they were this time 12 months ago to go on a bit of a run. It'll all depend on the draw, really. But I would not rule out Clare before the summer is out. Their odds have gone out to 14-1 to win the All-Ireland, but, you know, they've been down this road before, and you'd be a fool to write Clare off.
Do you think someone like Aaron Cunningham should start the next day for them? I mean, he looked, his pace alone and his skill, the second goal was just unbelievable.
Well, look, I'm not surprised. Aaron Cunningham, he's done it all before at under-21 level. And I think he's an incredible talent. And I think yesterday he really stood up within those last 20 minutes. He really brought Clare back into the game. So I think it's a no-brainer to start him the next day. And I think with Aaron Cunningham, you know, an informed Shane O'Donnell, Conor McGrath back, Tony Kelly, there's four, you know, John Conlon. That's a formidable forward line alone. And that's even without even mentioning Colin Galvin and possibly Podge Collins if he was to come back on board. Add in Brendan Bugler, possibly Shannon Amore might start the next day. You know, Clare did definitely have the personnel to push on, and you know, as I said, there's no one going to want to meet Clare in the qualifiers.
Okay, listen, we'll leave it there, John. Thanks so much for your time, appreciate it.
No, what are you? Thank you,
John Milan there. Okay, I'm delighted to welcome Limerick's Shane Dowling to the show as well. Hiya, Shane.
Hugh, how are we doing?
Not too bad, thanks. Well, Jesus, that was some win yesterday. A brilliant game, I have to say. I was watching it at home, and not a bad scalp to have in the bag before the end of May, I was thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I suppose it was great rivalry between ourselves and Clare, so absolutely it was great to get over the line. We said beforehand a 1-point win would do it, and that's exactly what we got.
And you got 11, so not bad for yourself.
No, but sure, I should have got about 16. But we decided something to work on for next day anyway.
You're allowed to say that. I can't say that. You know, I was looking at it, just going through the squad even yesterday, the lads were talking about it before throwing, and there's a nice blend of youth and experience there. The likes of Seamus Hickey, Donald Grady, John Fitzgibbon, and then the younger lads coming through. So it seemed to have a good balance in the squad at the moment.
Yeah, I think you said it. There's a perfect balance, I think. I suppose outside of Dad, really, you're probably looking at David Breen being the oldest in the panel, and he's only 28 or something, like, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of players that have that are there for the last 6 or 7 years. There's a lot of players that are there for the last 3 or 4 years, and then there's the new lads on again. So I think the blend is just perfect at the minute.
No shortage of confidence from that Keane Lynch lad, anyway.
No, sure, but that's Keane. He's a super guy with a super attitude. And I was delighted for him. And I wasn't one bit surprised he played the way he did. I suppose, you know, he would have had huge pressure on him last year, playing with the minors or whatever. And he was coming into yesterday, maybe with not so much pressure on his shoulders, you know. And maybe that's when you're allowed to express yourself. And gee, that's exactly what he done.
I think that's brilliant, though. Well, you know, even the interview at the end, no matter about how he played, which was brilliant, but then just well able to handle himself, so much self-belief for a 19-year-old. It's just brilliant to see.
Yeah, well, look, he's a super head and the shoulders, and you know, I've seen that for the last number of years. And listen, as I said, it was no surprise to me, and to be honest, I don't think it was a surprise to anyone in Limerick.
You were 19 when you made your senior debut in the National League, I think. What were you? Can you remember that? Would you have been that kind of confidence?
I don't think as much as him anyway. No, I think I probably would have had a small bit more nerves than he did. But even if he did, he didn't show it and miss it anyway.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Look, so before throwing, I was just kind of thinking, you know, after what happened with Dublin and the league campaign that probably, you know, didn't go as well as you would have liked, was there a kind of a confidence that you could go out there and win that match? Was there that self-belief that was pretty apparent on the pitch, and particularly in the second half?
Yeah, listen, since the Dublin game, you know, training has gone really well. It's really intense. We've pushed on, and I think it showed yesterday. You know, I think the last number of years, we've been very consistent in the championship, and thankfully we brought that again yesterday.
Yeah, but was it something you used, that Dublin match? I mean, was there anger? Was there a bit of frustration about it?
I don't know what it was. No, we just couldn't put our finger on it. While we, I suppose, overall didn't have a great league campaign, there was no excuse for going to Croke Park on a nice evening and putting a form like that. I can't put my finger on it. I don't know why, but
sometimes these things just happen, I suppose.
Maybe so, but I don't know. It was what it was, but we've quickly moved on from it anyway.
Yeah, well, I mentioned it to John. I'm going to ask you. I mean, you know, when Clare came back at you in the game yesterday, it would have been very easy for your heads to drop, but they didn't. And that must have been, for TJ as well, looking on at his squad like that, that must give him a huge comfort to see that strength that he showed, mental strength, towards the end.
Yeah, I suppose there is mental strength, and over the last number of years, I think we've showed that. But it's great when it works out. Listen, it's all about, it's a game of inches, and you know, you need a bounce of a ball. And I think, look, yesterday, while maybe I'm biased, I thought we were slightly the better team, I think we got the bounce of the ball, certainly, because on another day, you know, Clare could have got the result.
What about Tib?
Yeah, all I know is that they'd be gunning for us anyway. I think the last 2 years we've beat them anyway.
You have, yeah.
And so, yeah, they won't need any motivation coming down to Limerick. It's all making for a great game anyway.
Okay, listen, Shane, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on, and best of luck against Tip. There's a lot of new Limerick fans, I think, on the basis of that performance yesterday. So congratulations, well done.
A1, thanks for you.
Cheers, Shane. Thanks, Shane. Shane there. Yeah, brilliant. I tell you, I was delighted to see Limerick win that match yesterday. Delighted.
I watched the match, yeah. And the lad, the interview afterwards, young Keane Lynch, I seen it again on the Sunday game last night.
He's brilliant. 19 years of age.
Brilliant, yeah.
Strutting around the place.
But sure, even at that age, you to go in at 19, at that level, kind of first championship game, brilliant stuff.
Okay, take a quick break. We've got Donal Lennon on a lot of things to talk about on the rugby pitch after these.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
You're very welcome back. Now, earlier this afternoon, I sat down with Donal Lennon in studio and to talk basically all things rugby. Okay, we're talking rugby now. Donal Lennon joins me in studio. Hi, Donal.
Hi, Hugh.
We have to start with yesterday because it's freshest in the minds of rugby supporters here and for Connacht supporters in particular. How do I say this being neutral? There's no way, really. Connacht were robbed, were they?
Well, I think they were. I mean, the decision, 30 seconds on the clock. John Muldoon, Connacht captain, outstanding player over the years. I felt so sorry for him. You know, they're winning at that stage. He brings the ball into contact. You can see they're playing the clock. And Tom Palmer, the Gloucester second row, comes over the top. He's in an offside position. He makes no effort whatsoever to roll away from the ball. As a result of that, the supporting Connacht players cannot go in and clean out over the ball. Yet, Roman Pott gives the penalty against Muldoon for not releasing. Completely at variance to the way the refereeing of the breakdown had gone earlier in the game. And indeed, in extra
subsequent
time.
Subsequent to that as well.
Exactly, because Dennis Buckley was pinged for practically a replication of what had happened with Tom Palmer. So you can understand the frustrations of the Connacht public. I can fully understand Pat Lam. I mean, again, I just happened to be watching the 20 minutes at the end the night of that fateful decision in the Cardiff game, which, you know, they lost 4 points that night, which could have, you know, they may never have been in this playoff scenario for the Champions Cup. So really, you know, it tends to happen. I'd hate to call Connacht the lesser team, but sometimes you're not expected to do well and referees are looking for things against you. But it was an appalling decision. Connacht were, I thought, heroic. Their performance over the course of the 80 minutes was outstanding because once again they took their eye off the ball in the opening 2 minutes. They have this habit of conceding tries early. I mean, they handed 7 points to Gloucester in the opening 2 minutes.
Yeah,
they were under incredible pressure throughout the game, yet they scored some magnificent tries. I mean, Healy on the wing, for, you know, a guy we've spoken about before, he was with Lansdowne in the All-Ireland League only 2 seasons ago. He was absolutely outstanding. Also Tiernan O'Halloran, an unbelievable cover tackle in the corner to save what looked as if it would save the day. So the outcome is hugely frustrating, hugely disappointing for Connacht. And
you see the performance for me, Donald, just compounds the referee's bad decision at the end. And, you know, I would argue that he got both decisions wrong. You might have a different interpretation, but not only did he give a penalty against Connacht wrongly in most people's view, then the try subsequent to that that Gloucester scored, it looked like one of the Connacht players being held back, which is obstruction.
Yeah. I didn't look at that as forensically as the other one.
Sure, because we were also angry,
exactly,
I suppose.
Yeah. Well, look, it was a 50-50 call, but, yeah. You know, I could understand, you know, it could well have been obstruction. But, you know, to have two incidents within a period of 4 or 5 minutes, and for it to happen in extra time as well. I mean, but look, the bottom line for me is the game should never have gone to extra time. That penalty should have been a Connacht penalty. I would say there was 20 seconds left on the clock at that stage. You kick it to touch, you win your line out, hold it in for one or two phases, the game is over. They have that home playoff then. I mean, could you imagine the build-up next week if they were playing Bordeaux-Bailey, I think,
yeah.
Who it would have been a huge task for them, I think, in the context of a Sunday to a Saturday, a 6 day turnaround. Bordeaux have had an outstanding season under Rafael Ibanez, who, you know, could well be the French coach by the time the World Cup comes along. But look, that's if buts and maybe. If you were beaten at home, so be it.
Sure.
The manner in which they were beaten against Gloucester, I think, you know, it leaves a sour taste. And, you know, given, you know, where Connacht have been all year, they've had so many close shaves, it really must sting the whole party there.
You see, I wonder, you know, what's going to happen now. And the answer is probably nothing. Joel Juge is the head of referees. I mean, he has to look at that game, and Roman Pott has to be punished for what was an obvious glaring mistake. Everybody can see it. And we're not, you know, putting our Connacht bias hat on here. Sure, it's frustrating because we're Irish. We're looking at this, an Irish team. But, you know, Conor O'Shea in commentary yesterday was quite vocal about it. He was, there was a couple of English former internationals who agreed with him as well on what had happened. And, you know, I wonder, is there any recourse now for someone like
Roman? Well, I think there is recourse. I mean, the problem with the refereeing associate, they never come out and speak publicly about it.
Mm.
You may find that in 2 or 3 months, Romain Pott doesn't get the games that he should be getting.
Mm.
There is, you know, an appraisal system. If you were appraising his performance yesterday, I mean, it would have to be a D-.
And such a big stage as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's hugely frustrating. But look, I mean, you could look, there was incidents, if you like, in all the games over the weekend, the two Pro 12 finals, there was also big calls made, which could have changed the course of the... for both teams in the final. So
okay, well, let's move it on to Munster then, because they scraped through Ian Keighley didn't have one of his better days, and the decision at the end where Ospreys had scored a try but it wasn't given by the TMO, which would have effectively knocked Munster out, that, you know, that luck kind of went their way, if you like. But did they, on the balance of play, deserve to win?
They were the better team by a mile. I mean, like, the incredible thing, you know, when you kick 2 out of 7, and JJ, well, Ian Keighley had 2 out of 7, JJ Hannery come on and got probably some of the easier kicks than Keighley missed. So to miss 2 out of 8 kicks, I think the 15 points they left behind, they opened the door for Ospreys when they were 16-3 up 2 minutes into the second half. Great try by Dennis Hurley. Mm-hmm. Even Munster took the decision to take Peter O'Mahony off, who'd had a hip injury going into the game. I think they felt they were in the final, took O'Mahony off, made a change, Donica Ryan in the back row, Billy Holland in the second row. But, you know, breakdown of communication at the back of the scrum. CJ Stander has been outstanding all year. Another man of the match award for him. But literally invited the Ospreys back into the game. Reese Webb scores under the post, and, you know, it's game on. But you'd have to be worried from Munster's point of view, given that was a game that they should have closed out. The Munster of old, once they got your hands on your throat, they'd never take it off.
Absolutely.
It's been a recurring theme in a number of games. But yet, they've made it to the final. But again, you go back to a refereeing decision. The irony of the whole thing was the last play of the game, when a clear knock on, everybody in the crowd could see it, the reaction was there. Nigel Owens was a yard away from it. I don't know why he didn't call it up straight away. I was in line with it. He looked at the assistant referee almost for reassurance. He shook his head. So the play continued. Ospreys scored within 2 phases. Now, the TMO can only adjudicate going back 2 phases on a try scored. Had the Ospreys scored, if they had one more phase,
That's it, game over.
So, I mean, it was that tight, incredible. But my point is, Nigel Owens should have seen the knock on, and it should never have got to the stage where the TMO was involved. I mean, it was a blatant knock on.
Are referees afraid to make decisions now?
Well, I think, you know, because of the TMO, because assistant referees are more involved in games, there's no question that referees are almost afraid to be decisive,
yeah,
just in case they get it wrong in that 1%. You know, I do think Nigel Owens, unquestionably the number one referee in the world, but I think he's got besotted with this thing where, you know, my penalty count in a game is lower than anybody else, which is commendable. Normally the games that he is in control of are more attractive. But the bottom line is, if there's an infringement, it has to be called.
Sure.
You know, you can't change the laws to suit you. And I think, you know, had he called it there and then, no question the Ospreys knew that it was a knock-on. So they wouldn't have had the frustration of having to deal with scoring the try. Mm. I mean, Alan Wynne-Jones was up in arms. I think he thought that the Ospreys had more than 2 phases in the build-up to the Matavesi try. And therefore, he was on top of him. You can't go back. You know, so I mean, all of that would have been avoided had the correct call been made in the first place, where there was a knock on. So I mean, you know, it's fine margin. You look at the Guinness Pro 12 overall. I mean, 22 games in the regular season. There's 1 point separating the top 4 teams going into the last game. Even in the 2 semi-finals, there was, as we say, issues that, you know, Ulster obviously were up in arms over the the bit of play acting at the end, Lutton,
And Matawalu.
And Matawalu, you know, diving. You could see Rory Best's frustration after the game, but
yeah,
you know, it's one of those things, very difficult. You know, there is this thing, diving seems to be creeping into the game a bit now. There's no question it was a penalty, but Matawalu certainly
made the most of it. Yeah. I have to ask you, the last great iconic figure of the last 15 years, it looks like, has played his last home game for Munster. Paul O'Connell pretty much admitted so in the post-match interview on Saturday. And I'm just thinking, you know, Munster going forward over the next 2 years. Paul O'Connell is the name that you associate with Munster, you know, that even if a lot of guys have gone, the likes of O'Gara, the Wallaces, the Quinlans, whatever, the fact that Paul O'Connell's name is on a team sheet still means that Munster are there to be feared because of him. And he's going now. Where does that leave Munster?
It's ironic, really, because, you know, there's obviously Munster had issues in their backline all year. You know, they played a very restricted game. I think they've addressed that with some of the signings for next year. But I have this fear, BJ Botha could be gone at Christmas. Mm-hmm. Paul O'Connell Now looks as if next week will be his last game. Guinazu hasn't, the hooker hasn't been signed up yet. So therefore, Munster, traditionally their strength has been in the front five. You know, some things change, others stay the same. Munster are always competitive up front, but all of a sudden, you could now be vulnerable there. There's no question about that. But look, I think there was a realisation there. The best case scenario was Paul O'Connell was going to go on to next and he's you know, next season, but he was only going to be available for half the season because of the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there was a realisation that that day was coming fairly swiftly. It probably happened. I mean, there was a realisation within the crowd. The way Paul O'Connell was kind of came out and waving to the crowd, it wasn't a normal thank you at the end of a season. Sure. There was something more concrete about it, and that became obvious to everybody within a couple of minutes. Mm. And automatically, those who were there, everybody stood to their feet. They recognised this was a sort of an iconic moment, his last game in Thomond Park. And obviously, in an interview after the game, he more or less said that. But it is a challenge for Munster. I think, look, there are pluses there. Donnacha Ryan, 5 weeks ago, looked as if it was all over. Yeah. He's now back. He's had 3 or 4 80-minute games. I'm not saying Donnacha Ryan is Paul O'Connell, but Donnacha Ryan is a hell of a good player.
Sure.
And if he gets fit, that certainly is going to be a plus. But look, it doesn't matter when Paul O'Connell retires. He is a one-off. You know, he's the best forward that Ireland have produced, certainly in the professional era, and I would say in any era. You look at him the other day, even 35 years of age, his work rate at the breakdown, you know, you take his line of work and all that for granted at this stage, but it's his work around the field for a 35 year old is absolutely incredible. But I think there's a part within Paul who knows there's only so much left in the tank, and I respect a guy like that who makes the decision, look, call it early, which it would now appear that he's done. And there's speculation, is he going to France? What's he going to do? And when I heard this rubbish, to destroy his legacy in Munster, that is, what a load of rubbish that is. I mean, like, that guy owes Munster nothing. No question about that. If he wants to go away and have a year in France, then so be it.
Sure.
I know that he wants to get into coaching. Mm-hmm. And certainly France is going to be an option from that point of view. So therefore, for me, I always welcome when players, O'Gara has done it, Bernard Jackman has done it, Mark McCall has done it, Conor O'Shea is slightly different because he's been in England playing for London Irish since the mid-90s. But I admire fellas who go away to sort of expand their horizons abroad, learn different cultures, different approaches. And if Paul O'Connell goes away and coaches in France or whatever he wants to do, I've no doubt he'll come back and he will add much, much more to the Irish game.
Okay, listen, we'll leave it there, Donal. Thanks a million for your time.
Cheers, Hugh.
Some of your texts. What I liked about Bill O'Hurley was that he always finished his soccer programme with the words, "Good night and God bless." This was not politically correct to say and would not be said or allowed in any media organisation in Ireland or Britain. Doubt you, boy. You'll be missed, Bill, says Connor in Cork. Adrian Crawford on Twitter says, "Lovely tribute to the late Bill O'Hurley. He will be sadly missed. RIP. Jesus, I went and left the house for the gym. Didn't expect my eyes to be completely welled up before I got there. Lovely piece. RIP, Bill. Very sad. He was a legend. Hugh, in the words of another great broadcaster, Jimmy McGree, he was different class. And Bill O'Hurley certainly was all that," says David in Cork. "I'll never forget Bill having a fit of the giggles live on air during Mexico 86, says Philip in Clare. "I'm not a soccer fan, but always watch Bill. I'm heartbroken for his family, friends and fans. I'm at the kitchen table crying, but Bill was a true legend. Good night, good luck, God bless," says Maria Burke in West Cork. And lots more besides. Thanks so much for all your texts and tweets, and apologies didn't get to all of them, but just the nature of the day and the show that we had tonight. Our deepest condolences and sympathies, by the way, to Hilary and to his daughters Jill and Sally and all the grandchildren as well on the passing of Bill O'Hurley. We'll leave you with this. This is what Eamon Dunphy was referring to about that argument with Liam Brady. One of many, many brilliant moments in the career of a broadcasting legend. We'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Can I put a populist point to you that
another
Yes, another one, yeah. I'm looking at the crowds tonight. Now, we're top of the table, joint top of the table.
Half You're going to say that's down to the football
and
we play?
No, I'm going to
well,
say...
that's rubbish. Yeah,
that's what I'm going to say, yes. That we are not an attractive team.
Gamer on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.